compromis. Mais j'observe la terre at that time. I'm observing the world. So, you know, I'm pretty busy at that time. Yes. 'Cause I'm observing the world. Just a little bit more, a little bit longer. I promise I'm gonna come back.
Prison Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
That part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. Today is our annual funding drive show. Every year, CKUT, the station you're listening to right now, does a funding drive to help keep the station going so that we can keep bringing you shows like the Prison Radio Show and all of the other news and music shows that air on CKUT. The funding drive is CKUT's most important fundraising event of the year. Funds raised during the funding drive help with everything from paying our building's rent and the rent for our broadcast tower and transmitter to purchasing new equipment and repairing broken equipment and so much more. As a thank you to listeners who pledge, we have some gifts to give out. We on the Prison Radio Show have some books, one of which you'll hear more about on the show today. And we also have copies of the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar for 2016. To donate, you can go to ckut.ca or call the CKUT pledge line at 514-907-9424. Today on our show, we have two interviews. The first is with Ed Mead, who will be speaking to us live over the phone about his new autobiography titled Lumpin'. Our second interview is with Helen Hudson, a longtime member of the Certain Days Calendar Collective, who will be speaking about the calendar as a tool of resistance. So, the back cover of Ed Mead's recently published memoir reads, "From Iowa to Compton to Venice Beach to Fairbanks, Alaska, Mead introduces you to poor America just trying to get by and barely making it. When a 13-year-old Mead ends up in the Utah State Industrial School, a prison for boys, it's the first step in a story of oppression and revolt that will ultimately lead to the foundation of the George Jackson Brigade, a Seattle-based urban guerrilla group, and to Mead's reincarceration as a fully engaged revolutionary, well-placed and prepared to take on both his captors and the predators amongst his fellow prisoners." Longtime listeners of the Prison Radio Show may remember that Ed Mead did a lot of media work around the hunger strikes and the California prison shoes back in 2011, including speaking to us at the Prison Radio Show, and we are very excited to have Ed back on the show. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I'm going to get started, and just to warn people, I have some quotes from the book. The publisher gave me an advance copy, so spoiler alerts, but I won't give away too much. In the early part of the book, Ed summed up his politics saying, quote, "Like everyone, I had politics, although I didn't know it. I was an atheist, believed in the free enterprise system, and disliked big business, the government, and people who obviously had much more than they needed. I didn't really have any set convictions, however. I merely followed my impulses. I was also apolitical in a sense, as I never really gave politics any conscious thought. We shot at military planes to amuse ourselves, not for political reasons." Can you talk more about, or share some stories about, where your impulses led you to in early parts of your life?
Well, it's pretty clear from what you've just read that those impulses led me to imprisonment. That's, in fact, a judge once told me, he said, your problem is that you lack any impulse. You're impulsive. You lack any impulse control. So I don't know what all that means, but that's that.
Okay. You ended up in prison on McNeil Island twice, and the first time you were there, you learned a lot about the law. And the second time you were there, you met folks who identified as communists for the first time in your life. Can you talk about your changing political outlook during that period in your life?
Sure. Having started doing time at the age of 13 and pretty much doing life on the installment plan, one comes to identify, I mean, there you are in prison. The one thing you have in common with your peers is you've all been convicted of a crime. It isn't long before you start identifying criminally. In other words, the prisons themselves help to reinforce the recidivism process. And so, so it was the Vietnam War protests that primarily the people that my politics could have been considered right wing because I really didn't have any politics. But one thing that I was able to notice is that the people who supported the war in Vietnam were also the same people who supported the death penalty, who advocated for longer sentences for prisoners, who wanted to do away with parole. Whereas the people who were against the war were outside, on the docks outside McNeil Island Prison, where I was doing time. Protesting in support of prisoners, and they were for releasing prisoners. They were the ones that broke Timothy Leary out of jail. And so those are the kinds of things that started me thinking about, gee, you know, there's two sides to this whole thing. You know, which side am I on? They say that class consciousness is just a matter of knowing which side you're on, and class analysis is knowing who's there with you. So that's kind of how that unfolded.
Mm-hmm. You were released from McNeil Island for the second time in 1972, and in the book you talk about feeling really ready to organize on the outside, and you started organizing with the Washington Prisoners Labor Union, the National Lawyers Guild, and supporting the Attica Brothers. And in the book you talked about your organizing at this time by saying that it was important to us to be independent, to rely on our own members, and to not go chasing after grant money. And you said grant money is the kiss of death. Can you talk about this a little bit more? I feel like a lot of, I mean, not a lot, but some folks in the U.S. came around to this conclusion much later than the 1970s. And then if you feel like it, you want to talk about how grant money affected the political scene that you were in the early 1970s.
Sure. Here's the thing. The revolution is not going to be led by nonprofits. And the ruling class is not going to fund it. So right off the bat, why bother even going to them? There should be there's self-reliance in all matters. That's the approach that I'm advocating for prisoners. I can give you one good example. Back in the early 70s.
Yeah, sure.
There was the California Prisoners Union, and it was they published a statewide newspaper called The Outlaw, and they were a good organization. They were trying to organize. They wanted to be the official bargaining agent for prisoners in California. And dedicated people doing great work. And then they got a grant. And with the grant, they bought a building and hired people and did all kinds of things and became dependent on the grant money. And as soon as the grant money ran out, the prisoners union died. Hmm. It was just, you know, it was no more. They became dependent on the grant money and rather than their own resources and rather than the people that they're trying to serve. Whereas, you know, they should have been asking the union members for donations, for dues, or something, you know, along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to move on to the next question, which is an early manifestation. Well, I keep giving context for your book while I'm asking these questions, so it's half context and half questions. An early manifestation of the George Jackson Brigade involved you and friends supporting the strike of the United Construction Workers. And in the book, you talk about some pretty rowdy demos and an eventual firebombing of a racist contractor's headquarters. And you wrote, if someone asks you to join a demo and the organizers have asked the state for a permit to do so, stay away. If there is going to be no fire or smoke, stay away or else bring your own. Militancy breeds resistance. I guess I'm wondering, how did you incorporate these ideas into your life at the time? And how did other folks in your community respond to these tactics and this sentiment?
Well, first of all, in terms of, you know, the militancy and demonstrations, the Communist Party of France supported its own government against the Algerian national liberation struggle. The Communist Party of Cuba opposed Castro right up to the seizure of state power. I mean, the history of right opportunism on the left is huge. And so that they asked the state for a permit so that they can march from point A to point B carrying their signs, and they have marshals out flanking the marchers to make sure that nobody lights a dumpster on fire or, you know, something like that. These people are the loyal opposition. And the only place that they're going to lead you to is to your knees. That's all they're going to do. And as you said, militancy breeds resistance. There's the demonstrations should be spontaneous. Planned, but fast, people learn how to fight the police and win and get away. These are things that that people can learn as a result of that kind of conflict. In terms of the community reaction, the community responded very positively to the mass demonstrations that were taking place against the United Construction Workers. When it was decided to take that protest a step higher by firebombing one of the offices of the racist contractors, let me just give some context real quick. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is a struggle that took place in the Central District in Seattle, which is the black neighborhood. And there were a lot of construction projects taking place in the Central District during this period, but none of them were hiring black workers. And so United Construction Workers was an organization of black construction workers who were saying, hey, you know, you're doing this in our neighborhood. We would like some of these jobs. And that's what these protests were all about. The community reaction to what we did in terms of, you know, putting on ski masks and running in on construction sites and doing as much damage as we could, and then getting out before getting arrested. That was, you know, everybody supported that. When our little affinity group firebombed the headquarters of one of the racist contractors, we also went out. Nobody knew who did it, but we went out and kind of listened to what people were saying about it. And the overwhelming reaction of the community was positive. And so as a result of that, we went on to form the George Jackson Brigade.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about being underground, because once the George Jackson Brigade got started officially, you went underground. And in the mm-hmm. book you wrote, it says, on a personal level, being underground was no picnic. I was at the very least a federal parole violator and at most a wanted member of the George Jackson Brigade. As a result, we always had to be ready to fight. When I walked the streets or drove my car, it was with my Browning 9mm automatic tucked away in its shoulder holster. Had I been pulled over by the cops or stopped while walking down the street, I would have had no choice but to fight. I did not want to fight, and I feared having to fight, but I was always prepared for it. That was what revolutionaries did. If fighting me made them more cautious about approaching the next revolutionary, then it would be worth the sacrifice. Can you talk a bit about being underground and what kind of networks were set up for folks underground at the time? And also, like, how folks underground took care of each other, because it sounded like it was, you know, stressful at the very least.
Yeah, it was. I mean, try to imagine sleeping with a police scanner going all night, all day, all the time. And in fact, you get so accustomed to the dynamic or the rhythm of the police calls that I'll be sleeping away and I'll hear that dynamic change. There's like a more tension or something, you know, something's building, something's going on. There's more chatter, however you want to put it. Mm-hmm. And that will bring me out of a sleep. That'll bring me out of a deep sleep. And I'll listen to see, you know, could it be about us? And it never was. It was always, you know, some drug busters or something like that. But just that level of, tension is difficult, is stressful. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's personally liberating. You are very clear about which side of the class barricade you're on and what you're doing over there and how you're trying to do it. Mm-hmm. Life in the brigade was, you know, I don't know how to describe it. It was, you know, it was just, we all got along well. I was part of the brigade. There was no conflicts. And you know, we planned our actions and we did them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how to, in terms of what kind of networks we had, I'm not sure what you meant by that, but we did have, we had a country house and a townhouse, and the two were linked by, citizen band radio and, with big antennas, directional antennas. And so one thing we could do to relieve stress is we could go out to the country and just hang out there for a few days, maybe do some target practicing and, you know, just be away from the hubbub of the city. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, for sure. For folks just tuning in, we are speaking live with Ed Mead about his new book, his autobiography, which is called Lumpin. We were just talking about an underground organization, revolutionary organization from the 1970s called the George Jackson Brigade. And if you want to hear more about how the brigade works, there's lots of stories in Ed's book, and there are also other books that have been put out that Ed lists in his book that document the history of the brigade more closely. We are giving away copies of Ed's autobiography as part of CKUT's funding drive. If you want to donate, you can go to ckut.ca/donate or call 514-907-9424. We have about 15 minutes left to keep talking with Ed, and I have a few more questions. So around this point in the book, you start talking about something you call political faggotry. And you talk about deciding to try and get your emotional and sexual needs met by men instead of by women. And I'm wondering if you can talk more about the conversations and political development that led you to this conclusion at this point in your life.
Okay.
If you want, we can blend it into a question about men against sexism, but I also have a question about that later.
Oh, okay. No, I can do it.
Okay.
This was a period when this second wave of feminism was just starting out, and males, not many males, but some males, and I was one of them. Responded to this in a way that was supportive of women's issues. A lot of other males denied that there was such a thing of sexism or that our movement contained any discrimination or, you know, blah, blah, blah. One of the things that women complained about was that the men were draining their energy. The thousands of years of oppression of women by men has left them, you know, they drained, and women need their energy, you know, to overcome that history of oppression, and so. The conclusion I reached, and I don't know if I reached it or somebody reached it for me, but wherever it came from, it seemed like a good idea to me that we men, at the very tip of the spear, at the very head of the movement, should lead by example, and one way in which we could do this is by looking to meet each other's emotional and sexual needs rather than looking to women and draining women's energy in the process of our looking to have that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how that came to be. That's kind of how the idea of being a political faggot
cool
came into be.
Mm-hmm. In 1976, you were arrested in the course of a a bank robbery that the George Jackson Brigade was carrying out. And you ended up with 2 life sentences and a 25-year bank robbery sentence and a 5-year sentence for being armed during the commission of a federal crime. And you were placed in Walla Walla State Prison in Washington. And in the book, you talk about immediately beginning to challenge the culture of rape and sexual exploitation in the prison. Can you talk about this transition back into prison? Did your political outlook affect how you related to being back inside again?
Oh, yes, of course. Once you're, like the old saying goes, you know, once you've left the farm and seen big, you know, gone to the big city, it's hard to go back to the farm. And that was the same way. Once you're class conscious, I mean, once you're class conscious and you go into prison, I mean, that's all you are is just another front in the global class struggle. All you've done is just changed locations. Nothing else has changed. You're going to go about your business of organizing wherever you happen to find yourself on enemy soil, and that's kind of like I said, I had a whole lot of time, mm-hmm. more time than I thought I was going to be able to do, and I was going to do it the best way that I could. With respect to men against sexism, in all the different prisons I've been in, there's various ways that men try to set themselves apart from other men in terms of how they dress or, you know, something like that, to establish their place in within the prison's pecking order. And at Marion Prison, for example, the T-shirts they offered they call them wife beaters. I don't know what the T-shirts with the straps on each side. And that's what they issued. But if you had a regular T-shirt with little sleeves, then you were more cool. In another prison, they issued jock shorts, tidy whities. And so if you have a pair of boxers, then you're considered very cool. Well, at Walla Walla, at that time, how you earned your place in the prison's pecking order was by raping vulnerable, weaker prisoners, most often gay prisoners. And this was just part of the prison culture. It had been that way. It's always been that way. And that was just that was just normal for how things were. When I went into Walla Walla, the penitentiary, I was immediately placed in Big Red, the security housing unit. And being booked in with me was a young kid. Early 20s. He didn't talk to me. I didn't talk to him. We're each in our own little world of, being booked into a maximum security prisons, prison within a prison. And so, anyway, he gets put in one cell. I get put in a cell next to him. He's to my right. And, I'm in cell 10. He's in cell 11. I think that's what they were. And, they let groups of prisoners out for exercise, and they let a group of prisoners out, and they tried to rape this guy. They tried to get into his cell and rape him, and they were unsuccessful. But the point is the next day I went out and talked to people on the cell and on the tier during my exercise period, and saying, you know, what's all this about? And that's what they would say. Oh, that's just the way it is. So that was kind of the impetus for Men Against Sexism, is that in most prisons, the primary contradiction among prisoners is racism. But in this particular instance, that contradiction was sexism in terms of homophobia and rape and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How much time do we have left?
We have just under 10 minutes left. We have about 8 minutes left. So I'm going to skip to some of the other questions that I sent you.
Okay, that's fine.
Partly because people can read about Men Against Sexism. There's a zine that got published. You can find it online.
Right.
You can, you know, call us and ask us on the Prison Radio Show how to find it, and we'll find it for you. There's a lot of stories out there about Men Against Sexism.
Okay.
So you eventually got transferred around a lot. The way I understood it in the book is that you sort of organized your way out of prison. You went from Walla Walla to Marion to Leavenworth and eventually to Tennessee and then back to Washington State. And you did a lot of organizing inside. And you wrote about it and said, every prisoner knows that to achieve progress on the inside, multiracial unity is essential. Prisoners suffer class oppression. Many of them also suffer national oppression. And to this must be added gender oppression and oppression on the basis of sexual orientation. Prisonerhood is a specific status that infiltrates every aspect of daily life and touches on the very humanity of those being enslaved in this manner. It is around this status that prisoners must organize. Can you talk about some highlights from your organizing in prison? And also I'm curious, because you talk a lot in the book about building cadre versus mass organizing, and if you can talk about this distinction a little bit too for us.
Okay. I guess one of the best learning experiences would be the Florence, Arizona, organizing inside that prison. It was dominated by the Aryan Brotherhood. The cadre organizing is you're developing just a few people, but you're developing skill. You're developing political consciousness within those very few people. Mass organizing is you're focusing on, you know, large numbers rather than the quality of the individuals. So, like, in the Arizona experience, it was a mile wide, but only an inch deep, because it was mass organizing rather than cadre, and so cadre takes more time to develop, and it's, you know, it depends on the circumstances, but always for, you know, advice to anybody who's doing organizing on the inside is that class considerations must always be in command. Here in the United States, if you put a black president in, things would be marginally better for blacks. Or if you put a woman in the White House, things would be marginally better for women. Or if you put a gay person in the White House, marginally, you know, you get the idea here. But the wars, the operation of international imperialism, plundering the world's people and exploiting its own workers, that's going to continue no matter. So the issue of is not what, you know, gender in command or anything like that. What's got to be in command is class politics, is class in command of all questions. And if you keep that in mind when organizing on the inside, then you won't go wrong. And you won't wind up settling for some cheap reforms that cannot be enforced.
So I have one last question for you.
Okay.
Which is, you were released in 1993, I believe, and it sounds like since you've been released, you've kept your organizing focused a lot on prisoners and issues affecting prisoners. And you said towards the end of the book that you would like to keep trying to move social prisoners in the direction of rights consciousness, rights conscious prisoners towards class consciousness, and all the while preaching the need for class-based revolution, which you just talked about in the last question. So I guess my last question is, when you got out, like, what kept you focused on prison issues and prisoners after all these years?
Well, having spent something like 35 years of my life behind bars, we all organize around what we know, around, you know, what our own experiences. And my experiences as a prisoner, you know, I jokingly say, as a, you know, now I'm a retired professional prisoner. It's what I do. I mean, that's how I identify. That's how, you know, that's my bailiwick, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Who I am.
All right. That makes sense. All right, very, very last question. The Prison Radio Show has a lot of listeners inside prison. We've been telling folks how they can get a copy of our book by donating to the station funding drive right now, but do you have any idea how folks inside can obtain a copy of your new book? If you I can find the address for Left Wing Books and advertise it, but...
Well, I have an AK press address, but Prison Canada will have a very hard time. I mean, it would cost a lot to have it shipped from the United States. And I don't have an address here for Left Wing Books. I just have a phone number and email address. So maybe you could plug that in there somewhere.
Yes, we will look it up right now and plug it in later in the show. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us, Ed. It's been really great to talk to you.
Okay.
It was really great to read your
my
book.
Pleasure. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
For our listeners, that was Ed Mead. He recently published his autobiography called Lumpin', which is available from leftwingbooks.net from this local publisher in Montreal called Chris Blebedeb. There will also be a launch for the book on the evening of November 27th at Cooper Concordia. The book launch will also feature Jaleel Muntakim's new book, Escaping the Prism, as well as the 2016 Certain Days calendar. Keep your ears peeled for more information about that. And we are giving away copies of all three of these books as part of the funding drive, as well as a copy of Scapegoat's incarceration issue. So stay tuned for how to donate and possibly win a copy. And we're going to go to some ads.
Anxious about landing that first meaningful job in science? Come meet and interact with professionals from the biotechnology industry and academia. The McGill Biotechnology graduate students are proud to present the 5th Annual Biotechnology Conference, BioConnect, themed Revolutionizing Biotechnology, Stimulating Innovation Through Collaboration. Come listen to experts from the interdisciplinary fields of biotechnology and pave your way to a brighter future. Learn about research being conducted by students through an exciting poster session followed by drinks, dinner, and networking. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at BioConnect2015. Get your tickets soon at bioconnect.conference.mcgill.ca. Friday, November 6th at New Residence Hall, 3625 Avenue to Park, from 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. All are invited. Autumn blues weighing you down. Mercury in retrograde got you feeling dizzy. Struggling with the seasons of chapped lips and cold looms. We've got a warm and cozy escape from New Woes. CKUT and the Akal Project bring you Thursdays Alive, October edition. Bring your friends, bring your dates, bring your cool rock and roll moms. Snuggle up to performances by Easter, Alexia Vina, and Strange Fruits. Rumor has it, there might be apple cider. Where? The Akal House, that's 3559 University Street. When? October 29th, that's next Thursday. Cover? Free. Pay us with your hugs and smiles.
The time is presently 11:38, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Today's our funding drive show. If you like the Prison Radio Show and want to help keep us on the air, please consider donating to our host station, CKUT. We have some prizes to give out to folks who donate. To donate online, you can go to ckut.ca, and to donate by phone, you can call 514-907-9424. The Prison Radio Show is giving away copies of the Certain Days 2016 calendar, which you'll hear an interview about coming up next. We're also giving away copies of Ed Mead's autobiography. We were just hearing an interview with Ed Mead about his new book. As well, we're giving away a book by political prisoner Jaleel Muntakim called Escaping the Prism, which is a collection of poetry and essays written from behind the bars of Attica Prison. And for folks who may have been listening just before and are interested in getting a copy of Ed Mead's new book, folks on the inside maybe who aren't able to order it online, or for anyone who prefers to do it by snail mail, the address for Left Wing Books, also known as Kersplebedeb, I'll spell that out, it's K-E-R-S-P-L-E-B-E-D-E-B, and then it's CP63560, CCCP Van Horn, Montreal, Quebec, and the postal code is H3W3H8. Up next, we have an interview with Helen Hudson. Helen's a longtime member of the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. In this interview, Helen talks about the calendar as a collaborative project between some political prisoners on the inside and a collective of folks on the outside, and the calendar as a political tool and a tool of resistance. So I'm here with Helen Hudson, a longtime member of the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Noah. Good to be here.
So to start off with, can you tell us a bit about the history of the project, maybe how it came to be, a bit of the context in which the calendar was created?
Sure. Well, the calendar was created out of an already existing collaboration between some prisoner justice organizers in Montreal and a number of political prisoners in New York State, all of whom were held close to Montreal. So to backtrack a little bit, New York State has a lot of prisons in it. There's sort of a policy, formally or informally, of putting people as far away from their support as possible. So for the political prisoners in question, that means as far away from New York City as possible. In other words, close to Montreal. So there had been a relationship between folks here in Montreal and folks on the inside, particularly Herman Bell, who's a former member of the Black Panther Party for quite some time, a number of years already. And Herman proposed the idea of having a calendar produced together as a collaborative project inside and outside. And so that was started up in 2001 to produce the 2002 calendar as the first edition of Certain Days between Herman Bell, David Gilbert, and Robert Seth Hayes, who are three political prisoners in New York State, and a collective in Montreal. Since that time, it's developed into the outside folks being in Montreal and Toronto, and still those same three prisoners who are all still incarcerated in New York.
And so can you maybe describe a bit about how logistically it's worked in terms of working with the folks inside and then the collective of folks on the outside?
Well, I mean, I'm guessing as a lot of listeners to Prison Radio will be familiar with, the prison wall is a barrier to communication in a whole range of ways. And there's a range of ways to work around that. So visits and letters. Initially, we were able to do a lot of visits, but as the outside collective members, as our lives have changed, you know, used to be we were kind of young people with like no family responsibilities and not 9-to-5 jobs, so we'd be able to go visit a lot more often than we can now. But on the flip side, over the years, we've developed relationships with each of the prisoners' other outside supporters. So now it's some visits, a lot of letters, but also being able to be in email contact with close supporters of each of those prisoners who are then in phone contact with the prisoners. So we try and have as much back and forth communication with the guys on the inside as we can. And because we on the outside are some in Montreal, some in Toronto, we do end up using the internet a surprising amount for a project that operates across the prison walls. We do a lot of our meetings online. And then rely on good old snail mail to send drafts into the guys inside.
So in terms of putting the calendar together each year, can you describe a little bit about how that works, how you go about getting the artwork and articles that are in the calendar every year?
Well, the first step is to figure out a theme. I don't know if I should maybe backtrack and like explain to listeners a little bit more. I'm guessing a lot of your listeners are familiar with the calendar, but for folks that don't know, it's a calendar that, you know, hangs on your wall like any other calendar, tells you what day it is. But for each month, there's a piece of art. But then in the back or in the front, like before or after the month pages, there's articles for every month as well. So there's a lot of information about, prisons, but also about other social justice issues. So every year we have a theme, some or other social justice issue. For this year coming up, 2016, it's internationalism, solidarity, and global struggle. So the first step, to get back to your question, the first step is to to figure out the theme. In general, it's been one proposed by one of the Inside contributors. And this year, it was David Gilbert's idea to focus on internationalism. So then we do put out a general call. Anyone can submit to the calendar. If one would like to receive those calls, check out our website for our contact info. We're at certaindays.org. Our email is info@certaindays.org. So we send a general call for articles and then general call for art, but we do also get in touch with specific individuals, both prisoners and folks on the outside, and ask them to contribute if there's either existing work, an existing art piece or article that we find fits the theme really well, or if there's you know, somebody that we think would be well placed to write on a certain topic. So for example, in this year's 2016, the calendar that's just coming out now, there's a piece by Ray-Luc Levasseur, who's a former political prisoner who's now out on parole, but who got involved in the work that he did through being a Vietnam vet, like by fighting in the Vietnam War and then having his eyes open to what the war was really about and then turning around into anti-imperialist work instead. So we thought he would be really well placed to write on that theme. So we just got in touch with him individually and he submitted an article, which is, I think, one of the strongest pieces. I mean, they're all strong pieces, but it's one of the things that excites me most about this issue is his piece.
You mentioned that every year there's a theme for the calendar. Can you talk a bit about some of the other themes that have been in past years and kind of just some of the ways in which those came about or how they were proposed or why certain themes were chosen?
Well, as you and I think your listeners know, prison just kind of touches everything, right? Like it's sort of one of those cornerstone issues when you talk about any kind of social change, any kind of, you know, just society. So in some ways, the harder part is like, choosing a theme among the many obvious themes. We've had the Indigenous struggle theme. We've had the legacy of the Black Panthers. We've had land and eco justice. Geez, what else? We had migration, all kinds of stuff, really. And, you know, for all of these themes, as I'm throwing them out, I'm guessing that listeners of your show will immediately see the connection to prisons. But for each of those issues, what we're trying to do is make those connections and say, like, look, you know, there's all these folks inside. There's folks who are inside for political reasons who've been imprisoned for their activism. There's folks who have radicalized inside, you know, doing work around this theme. And, you know, there's just lots to say. And one of the overall goals of the calendar is to continue to make those connections for folks that maybe are aware around the issue of the theme, but don't know how it connects to prison and don't know how many people are on the inside and don't know what prison is doing to society overall. We try and use the calendar as an outreach tool, much like CKUT is an outreach tool, much like the same way that that Prison Radio does its work.
In terms of outreach to folks on the inside, what are some of the ways that the calendar gets to people who are in prison?
You know, it's largely word of mouth. The guys that are involved in the calendar, they tell folks that they're talking to. We've often also had an ad in Prison Legal News, which is a publication that I don't know if it goes into Canadian prisons. A lot of the calendars are actually sold in the States. And I know stateside that Prison Legal News gets into a lot of prisons. But yeah, like I said, word of mouth. You know, one prisoner has a calendar, shows it to friends, shows it to people on the range. And it's another way that just the sheer fact of having a calendar is political. A lot of prisons, you're not allowed to have a calendar. And, you know, it's just part of that overall sensory deprivation, not knowing what day it is, what time it is, what month it is, when you're counting the days till you get out, when you're trying to, you know when your kid's birthday is coming up so you can remember to write them on the outside and let them know you haven't forgotten. A calendar is a powerful enough tool that when there was the Pelican Bay hunger strike in California, throughout the California prison system a few years ago, one of their demands was the right to have a calendar. They, you know, they went on hunger strikes, some of them to close to the death, to be allowed, among other things, of course, but to be allowed to have a calendar. So, you know, once somebody, you know, in a given prison on a given block has a calendar, they tend to show it to their friends, and we'll get requests from prisoners just saying, you know, can you send me one?
Can you maybe just expand a bit on what you're just saying in terms of a calendar being something very political in the context of prison and how the Certain Days calendar in specific connected to to prison or justice and prison abolition work?
Well, there's sort of two aspects to it. Like the calendar part, like I was just saying, prison, as I think your listeners will know, is about sensory deprivation. I mean, it's about, you know, the deprivation of freedom. But, you know, every day you're in the cell, it looks the same. You don't know what day it is. You don't know what season it is because you're separated from nature. You're separated from your community. And so everything just kind of runs together. And being able to keep time becomes important, becomes a way to just kind of not have everything just run into like one big sensory deprivation. We get the calendar turned away from prisons a fair bit. Part of that is about them not being allowed calendars. Like sometimes the rejection sheet, just the box of what it's violated, is checked as no calendars. But this calendar in particular is quite political. For folks that don't know it, I mentioned the articles and the artwork, which are very political in and of themselves. But on the actual, you know, day pages, like the little square that is each day, we mark anniversaries of all kinds of stuff, social justice related and prison related. So you'll see, you know, Christmas on December 25th, but on August 10th, you'll see Prisoner Justice Day, but you'll also see why, like you'll see that death commemorated. You'll see days that certain political prisoners were captured. You'll see days that people's release was won in the case that, you know, we're able to win freedom for some of the folks on the inside. You'll see dates of uprisings that have happened around the world that have been influential. So, you know, we know that it gets rejected for that reason too, but that's also one of the things that I think makes it a powerful educational tool and, you know, just another way to reach across the walls. Again, like Prison Radio is, I keep emphasizing the ways in which the calendar is like Prison Radio, but I guess part of the reason I'm doing that is I know it's the funding drive show and I would love for people to buy the calendar. I'll give that contact info at the end, but I would also love for people to support CKUT because, you know, everything I'm saying about the calendar also applies to CKUT and to Prison Radio in specific.
So it is the funding drive and we'll be airing this as part of our funding drive show. And we actually have some calendars that we'll be giving away for folks who donate. We can give more details about that. But I guess before we kind of finish up and talking about that, maybe one question I have is I know that sometimes collectives who are working with folks on the inside will make what's called perpetual calendars. So they're kind of meant to be used indefinitely. You change them year to year. You can write in the dates, etc. But the certain days calendar is not a perpetual calendar. It's a yearly calendar like most other calendars. And I'm wondering if you can say anything about what went into the decision to do that versus maybe having a perpetual calendar.
You know, I don't think we really talked about it in depth. It was proposed as a you know, a yearly calendar. We've seen over the years some other perpetual calendars come out that are a similar idea in some ways, you know, like that mark all those anniversary dates on the calendar. And I mean, part of it is that we want to do ongoing outreach work. Like we want to have a new calendar every year to like include new articles, to include new artwork. Part of it also, you know, we never really explored that as a collective. But one thing that a yearly calendar does is, you know, again, for folks on the inside, but also outside users of the calendar, things change from year to year. Like you want to know when Yom Kippur or Ramadan is going to be. Like it's not the same every year in terms of the Western calendar. You know, you want to know what day to set the clocks forward or back, etc., etc. You know, you care when the full moon is. Like all of those things change from year to year. And so those are things that are all in certain days that, you know, prisoners don't have access to another way necessarily other than their calendar. If somebody's, you know, Muslim on the inside and wants to know when to begin and end the fast, you know, Ramadan is in there, and you know, they might not have any other access to that information. But for folks on the outside too, you know, like that's something that a perpetual calendar can't provide.
So as we were just talking about, it is the funding drive show, and like Helen mentioned, it would be great if people wanted to buy a copy of Certain Days calendar. Can you tell people how they can go about doing that?
Well, other than pledging to CKUT and getting one as part of your prize package, which I certainly encourage you all to do. So that the first five people that hear this, I guess, can do that. But what everybody else can do is go to certaindays.org. That's certaindays.org. days with no spaces .org and order a calendar online. It's $12 per calendar, although it is $5 for prisoners. Prisoners, of course, also can't go online. So I'll give the mailing address. It's Care of Kupirg Concordia. I'll spell that Q-P-I-R-G Concordia, like Concordia University, C-O-N-C-O-R-D-I-A, 1455 de Maisonneuve West. So Care of Kupirg Concordia, 1455 de Maisonneuve West. I guess I should spell de Maisonneuve too. D-E space M-A-I-S-O-N-N-E-U-V-E West. So then Montreal, Quebec, H3G as in George, 1M as in Michael, 8. So you can write there and send a check made out to Kupirg Concordia, $5 plus $3 for shipping for the first calendar and $1 additional for each additional calendar if you're ordering by mail. The other thing I should mention also is that if there's organizations out there who want to use the calendar as a fundraiser, we have a bulk rate of $8 per calendar. So then, you know, you buy 10 or more calendars from us for $8 each and then sell them for $12. And we really encourage folks to do that because, like I was saying, we like to make the connections between prison abolition and other kinds of social justice work. So if you're a group that's, you know, trying to save a wetland near you or trying to, you know, organize a union in your workplace or trying to stop a deportation of your friend or whatever you might be doing, if you could use some funds, we offer it as a fundraising tool as well. So that's definitely something that folks should get in touch with us either through our website or through the mailing address that I just gave.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or anything else you might want listeners to know?
I guess I'll just say again, I said it before, but that this year's theme, the 2016 theme is internationalism, solidarity, and global struggle. So, you know, I mentioned Ray Luke's article. There's stuff in there about, all kinds of issues. Indigenous struggle, migrant justice, struggles around the world of various peoples, like freedom struggles in the Philippines, in the Middle East, like all kinds of stuff that you might not necessarily expect to find in a calendar that's about prisons. But check it out and give to the funding drive.
Thank you so much, Helen.
That was an interview with Helen Hudson, a member of the Certain Days Calendar Collective, speaking about the calendar as a collaborative project between prisoners and folks on the outside, and the calendar as a political tool and a tool of resistance. The time is 11:56, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. Today is our funding drive show, and it's not too late to donate to the Prison Radio Show as part of CKUT's annual funding drive. Donating to CKUT helps keep us on air, so please consider donating if you can. We have some prizes to give out to people who donate. We have some copies of Ed Mead's book. We had an interview with Ed Mead earlier in the show, and we have some copies of the Certain Days calendar that you were just listening to an interview about, as well as copies of the new book by Jaleel Muntakim, which is entitled Escaping the Prism. In order to donate, you can go to ckut.ca or call the CKUT pledge line at 514-907-9424. Check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, November 12th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah.
And my name's Virginia.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.